Hey there, my name is Dan.
My name is Joshua, and we are the Unauthorized Critics Circle.
Now, Joshua, tell the listener what we do here at the UCC.
With pleasure. Here at the UCC, we review theater
with the normal bitcheries and qualms
by watching the video recordings
from questionable origins
of various productions. Hey, Dan, how are things?
The world is full of wonderful things, a bushel of wonderful things for me to believe in. So world, take me back.
Goodness gracious, Dan, I've never heard you start an episode happy. This is unsettling.
And bid goodbye.
What are we watching, Jerry Herman show or
something? Trouble and tears, I wasted so many odd years. It's time to get even, so world, take me back. I wanna let laughter light up my face again.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to the podcast. Hey, Dan, what are we talking about today?
Today we're talking about Mucha Courage und Ihre Kinder.
Jesus Christ, not again.
Which is why I'm so happy.
That's, the spirit raiser that is Mother Courage. Hey, we did in fact happen to watch Hello, Dolly today. We saw specifically Donna Murphy is Hello, Dolly.
Donna Murphy, who I saw in Dear World. I just saw her in Dear World.
Wow, you're having a big year for Donna Murphy and Jerry Herman musicals.
Sure. You know, she's the one Dolly that I missed. Well, I mean, I missed Carolee Carmello, but everyone missed Carolee Carmello because there was this thing, I don't know if you're familiar with it, there was this thing called the COVID-19 pandemic.
And I'm not sure that's... I don't think we got that over here.
You didn't get the tour because the tour stop in Toronto was canceled even before the pandemic.
It was. Yeah.
But Carolee Carmello
before the pandemic. It was going to come here, and then before the pandemic happened, they're like, oh, never mind.
Yeah, I was planning to go see Carolee in Toronto and Dolly, and then it was canceled, and then I was trying to figure out where to go see her and Dolly, but the pandemic happened, and I missed her. But besides that, the only other Dolly I missed was Donna Murphy.
Hmm. Is that why we picked
her? Mm-hmm. That's why we picked her, yeah, because I saw her in Dear World, and I hadn't seen her in Dolly, and I wanted to pick something happy.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're just late posting this.
And this podcast is just completely, utterly suited to your whim, so we pick everything you want, right?
Wow, that was passive-aggressive.
I have no clue what you mean. I've never been passive-aggressive in my life, bitch. Anyway, back to... this is a little late. You know, sometimes you're about to record the next episode and you take a little nap beforehand and you wake up and, oh no, a month has passed. It's happened to the best of us. I could name 10 other podcasts this has happened to. You know, this is just the state of the game.
Are those other podcasts real or are they in your head?
I don't understand why you're being pedantic about it.
What was your experience with Hello, Dolly?
You know the movie WALL-E?
Don't even. Don't fucking even. I've never seen it. I don't care. That doesn't count.
The beginning of the movie WALL-E starts with a recording, Michael Crawford's recording of Put On Your Sunday Clothes. And then you zoom more and more into the world and you see this absolute wasteland and there's a TV that's playing Put On Your Sunday Clothes from the movie. And we find out that there's this little robot guy who's just stranded on a decrepit, isolated, dead Earth. And the only thing he has to watch in his spare time is a VHS of Hello, Dolly. And that is his only entertainment for years and years.
VHS?
Yes.
I'm sorry. No, it had to be a DVD or something. The VHS would have degraded.
No,
it wouldn't have still played.
Well, you know what? It's a cartoon movie for children. It didn't seem crystal clear or anything. It was just, you know, it was a VHS. Anyhow, that was my only really impression of the show for a long time.
Could you repeat that?
That was my only impression of the show for a long time.
Could you repeat what you're really saying?
I'm heterosexual. Happy Pride, folks. Anyhow.
I don't know if I can continue with this episode.
It was my only... We're fucking 5 minutes in, Daniel. It was my only impression of the show for a long time until I had the fortune of seeing Dame Bernadette Peters live in concert, in which she performed two songs from Hello, Dolly, and they were the first times I'd ever heard songs from Hello, Dolly that weren't Put On Your Sunday Clothes and the title number, which everyone and their mother knows. Had you seen Hello, Dolly before? He says, taking off his headphones and pouring himself a nice hot cup of coffee in the meantime.
You always make this joke. You always make this joke.
Because
and, you know,
every time...
Diminishing returns.
No, because every time there's a show, I know you go, go ahead, tell the audience about how you went to go see it, tell the audience about how you did whatever, and how it's Toronto. You always do that pandering, condescending bullshit. Let me have my moment in the sun.
I don't do the pandering. I'm giving you your space.
You're giving me my space in a way that undermines me.
I can't control that.
Well, that's for damn sure.
I can't control whether or not you feel undermined.
Well, I think that to that extent I disagree.
What do you mean?
Are you at all familiar?
What do you talk? What do you talk? He's a music man.
No, go, God. We're losing the plot, folks. Had you seen this show before? I'll take that as a no.
I had seen this show a number of times. I saw Sally Struthers before the Bette Midler revival. I saw Sally Struthers.
You said that was such a hick accent? Sally Struthers.
Sally Struthers? Because how else do you say that? Sally Struthers?
Yes. It just makes her sound like a fucking character from Shucked.
She's a character from something. That much is clear. I saw Sally Struthers, and I loved the cast album, and I saw the revival with Bette Midler. I've recounted that story many a time.
Uh-huh.
I saw the revival with Bernadette Peters, and I saw Betty Buckley on the tour three times.
Three times?
Three times. Three times. Exactly.
Oh, Christ. I don't need to be reminded of current affairs. I need to be brought back to the golden age.
Saw Betty Buckley three times. And of course, there's the movie. Yeah, I know Dolly well.
Nice. What's the best version of the show that you'd seen?
What do you mean?
You sound like you have a familiarity with Hello, Dolly. You've seen it before. Mm-hmm. You know, live or otherwise. What is, to you, the peak iteration of Hello, Dolly? Having seen the movie, having seen Jerry Zaks' production, having seen Smucker's Jam.
Smucker's Jam?
Yeah, that's what you said.
Are you making a joke about her feeding all of those starving kids in Africa?
Obviously. Who does she think she is?
Poor Sally Struthers. She can't catch a break. What was the best I've seen this show? Is that basically the question?
Yeah.
You know, there are three nights of theater that I think were possibly the best in my life. They all happen to be revivals, and maybe I'll feel different about original productions the farther I get out from them. But best three evenings I've spent in my life in the theater. Yiddish Fiddler on the Roof.
Mm.
The Lincoln Center revival of King and I. And Bette Midler and Hello, Dolly. And, I mean, the production is beyond reproach, and seeing her in the show, 10 out of 10, no notes.
So, jumping off that point, knowing that this is, we're going to be talking about one of the greatest theatrical experiences of your life, let's first start with just Hello, Dolly as a musical.
Sure.
Had you ever seen The Matchmaker? Or read The Matchmaker?
Well, I'm trying to think because I had a book of Thornton Wilder plays, and The Matchmaker was in there. I think I read it. I don't 100% remember, but I read a good 90% of that book, so it probably I had to probably read it.
I'm curious to what extent, like how faithful of an adaptation this is, you know?
Extremely.
Extremely? Interesting.
Extremely, yeah. Huh. It's pretty much a cut, copy, paste.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, here's the play. We're going to take these moments and turn them into songs. They do some structural things that are slightly different, but it's pretty much exactly word for word the play.
Word for word. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Who's credited with the book for this? Is it, like, is there a
Michael
book
Stewart.
So is it, like, as much a question of Stewart's book, or is it a question of Wilder's play?
I think they're probably equal.
Okay. Hello, Dolly, the musical extravaganza.
Why did you give it that subtitle? That's not the official subtitle. What you is can't say that title? Like it's the name of the play.
What's the official?
Wasn't it? Well, that's the other. It wasn't originally titled Hello, Dolly. It was something, something, that damned exasperating woman.
What?
I believe it was Dolly Levi, that damned exasperating woman, originally.
Oh. Interesting.
Yeah. It, like, Hello, Dolly was not written as the title song. The song was written, and then they chose to title the show Hello, Dolly.
That kind of makes sense, I guess.
Uh-huh. Dolly, a damned exasperating woman. Yeah.
Dolly, a damned exasperating woman. My God.
And then Call on Dolly, but eventually they realized...
Oh, I like Call on Dolly.
Well, they realized that Hello Dolly was going to be a huge pop hit, probably, and that's when they changed the name.
Business decision.
Yeah.
Well, it's a good song. It's a pretty good song.
Hal Prince wanted it cut.
Oh.
Hal Prince wanted it cut.
I'm kind of not surprised to hear it.
He directed a production of The Matchmaker, and they were having trouble finding a director for Hello Dolly. David Merrick offered Hal Prince direct Hello Dolly, and Hal Prince, of course, was mostly known as a producer at the time, and
he... Yeah, this was the early 60s, right?
This was 64. He hadn't really gotten into the world of directing. David Merrick knew Hal Prince wanted to start directing, and so he offered the job to Hal Prince. He said, "You're hiring me so you can fire me. This is a publicity stunt. You're not actually offering me this job. You're offering me a headline of David Merrick fires Hal Prince. I'm not doing it. And furthermore, you have to cut the song Hello Dolly, because if you've read the play, she's never been to the Harmonia Gardens in her life. They never had the money to go there."
Hmm.
It's a front that I am going back to the Harmonia Gardens and everyone's going, no, she had never been there in her life. But the musical theater truth of the matter is you have a major star. She walks down the staircase. You gotta have a big number.
And, you know, as Oscar Hammerstein II famously said, sometimes a theatrical truth outweighs a dramatic one.
Mm-hmm. And even sometimes musical theater truth outweighs a dramatic truth.
Yeah.
And Hal Prince, one of the rare cases in his book, he published Contradictions, and then Sense of Occasion was the expansion of that book. And
yes.
In Sense of Occasion, he told the Dolly story in Contradictions. The first half of Sense of Occasions is Contradictions with added notes. And Hal Prince basically admitted that he was wrong about Dolly. He said that the original production ran X amount of years. The revival with Bette Midler is currently running. I went to go see it, and with all of the financial sense the show made, who am I to judge, is basically what he wrote.
Fair enough. Anyway, all this to say,
Hello, Dolly as a musical altogether?
It was troubled.
How so?
It was troubled until it came together. They didn't have an Act One ending.
Huh.
You saw it, and at the beginning of Act Two was, I put a penny in my pocket, and then a little time, the penny in my pocket
had turned into a dime. And that was only included for the first time in this production, wasn't it?
Yes, that used to be where Before the Parade Passes By was.
What?
It used to be where Before the Parade Passes By was.
What? What do you mean?
That entire scene wasn't there. That entire scene of the parade, going, and Ernestina Money is going to meet you. That was not in the show. He sang Penny in My Pocket, and it was a big production number.
Oh, what?
And so he's talking about, I shaved the ice to ice cubes and raised it higher price. We saw all of that.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we saw all of that. Oh, that it was sucks. A very expensive production number.
I don't need show, Penny in My Pocket literalized.
The show wasn't working.
Well, it seems it makes sense.
And here we get to the controversy of Dolly.
Mm.
They're out of town. It's not working. They added two songs in by Bob Merrill.
Oh.
Elegance and Motherhood are both Bob Merrill songs. They are not Jerry Herman songs. And Bob Merrill was one of Jerry Herman's mentors. The controversy of Dolly. Before the Parade Passes By. Is it a Jerry Herman song?
Oh, boy.
This is an open question.
Oh, wow.
Most people believe it to be a Charles Strauss and Lee Adams song.
Oh.
And the story that Charles Strauss tells in his autobiography is they went down to Washington where the show was playing its out-of-town tryout. They got out the script of The Matchmaker. They realized we're here to do something about Penny in My Pocket. It's gotta go. They looked through the script and they found about three different bits of dialogue from three different scenes. And they strung those together. Ephraim, Let Me Go. Boom. That'll intro the song that we're going to write. There's the bit of dialogue that she does with Horace Vandegelder.
Vandegelder.
And you're taking away my bride. Whatever that bit is, you know? Parade has finished, and yes, she's going to do the parade tag right at the end. In between that, they found that in the script. They realized that needed to be there, and they do a reprise of the song that they wrote. And they wrote a song called Before the Parade Passes By. Where there is some debate is, and what Charles Strauss kind of intimates, is it's their song, but on the way to the stage, Jerry Herman rewrote either some of the lyrics or some of the music. It was not both, it was one or the other.
Okay.
So Jerry Herman's hands seem to have been on the song, but the entire scene and the existence of the song
was devised by Strauss and Adams.
Strauss and Adams, yeah.
Okay. Huh.
And the debate is that Charles Strauss is being tactful. He wrote the entire song, only didn't want to say that while Jerry Herman was alive. And I, you know, this used to be how musical theater was made. The show is in trouble.
Yeah.
You bring in a different songwriter. Jerry Herman added a handful of songs to Ben Franklin in Paris. So he was on the other side of this.
So it was like a reciprocal, yeah. And I mean, that's not even just the case in the writing perspective. You hear about all these directors who sort of happen into shows while they're on out-of-town tryouts and go like, yeah, I'll salvage it. Fosse did it. Robbins did it. Yeah, this absolutely was the way musical theater was made, especially in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, for one of the most iconic numbers in musical theater history, that's...
And to have questionable lineage.
Yeah. It's a bastard, but we don't even know... We don't even have the 23andMe.
Well, and Carol Channing, of course, famously said... That the evening Hello
Dolly.
I'm not going to be doing a Carol Channing impression. I'd rather. She did say that, not. Though. Well, of course she did, but.
Well,
I'm going to be respectful of everyone involved with this episode, and I'm not going to have Carol Channing dominate the conversation.
Okay. That's okay. A first.
But Carol Channing famously said that the evening that Dolly became a hit was the evening before the parade passes by went in. Because they had found the spine of the show, and you had a reason, an emotional reason, to root for Dolly. She's not wrong. It's also a really big thing to say the reason the show is a hit is not because of your actual composer. But in her telling of the story, she got a call at about 2 a.m. at the hotel, and Jerry Herman called her down to his hotel room and taught her the song. So she 100% backed up that it was a Jerry Herman song as far as she knew it.
Like, to what extent is this even a conspiracy theory versus just, like, short of confirmed?
What do you mean?
Like, I want to say this sounds like one of the great conspiracy theories in musical theater, but it also sounds like Strauss is outright sitting here going, like, yeah, that's the truth.
He confirmed it. He confirmed it.
Fuck.
I think one of the big changes, musical comedy to musical theater, and now we've almost honestly gone beyond musical theater, and it's now just music theater, which is related to opera in some way, at least the good shows.
Sure.
The big change, possibly, is the idea of authorial voice. A Sondheim show is a Sondheim show. And a Herman show is certainly a Jerry Herman show. Not to say that Cole Porter doesn't have a recognizable voice, but these older shows where you get songs that are interpreted in... I mean, you saw the show for the first time. Did you look at any of those songs and say that's not a Jerry Herman?
Not necessarily, I guess.
And
in hindsight, hearing that, like, Elegance wasn't a Jerry Herman song, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense, but that's in hindsight.
Yeah. The difference is now we have author. Author is sacrosanct to everything rather than it's a community effort. I mean, Michael Stewart is credited with the book, but the greatest piece of book construction, I just said, before the parade passes by, it was Strauss and Adams.
Yeah.
And most of the script is the Thornton Wilder script. And yes, Michael Stewart did a great job. He tied some ends together. He helped out, but I mean, it was community effort. Whereas nowadays, to just pick the last best musical winner, A Strange Loop, that's 100% nothing but Michael R. Jackson.
Yeah.
And could only ever be.
It's a changing of tide, I guess. Like, it's just a complete different universe of art construction that we're talking about here. This is... It sounds alien now, but that's just... That was like, yeah, this is how it happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to touch back on that and to look at it as, like, a relic, you know, of, like... This used to just be everything in service of the final product rather than in service of the artist's vision or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You made the show to make the show, not to say your piece.
Mm. Not that one is better or worse than the other.
But... No, it's just a completely different, attitude. It's just like, that's not a way that art is looked at all right now. Damn. How recognized are Strauss and Adams for this by the creator? Like, is that just like a nerd thing to know, or is that like...
It's a nerd thing to know.
Okay, damn.
I mean, it was kept so under wraps for years and years, and it was something you would hear whispered about and still to this day to actually get any kind of honest to God conversation, you have to be enough of a nerd that you went on Amazon and bought Charles Strauss's book and read the entire thing like I did.
Well, fair. All this to say, beyond sort of the tidbits about what is Michael Stewart's and what is Yuri Herman's, whatever it is, to talk about it all as a Gesamtkunstwerk. Hello, Dolly, altogether as a musical, feels like a Yuri Herman musical in a specific sense of curation, which is this story of a woman who has lived her life and is here for one last blaze of glory triumph. Yuri Herman not to say that that's everything. I mean, obviously, you know, you look at Lacage or something and it's, well, I guess that's kind of about a woman who's...
Dolly has aged up over the years. Carol Channing was about 45.
Oh. I guess I meant that in a widowed sense. You know, that she has had this chapter of her life of Dolly and husband, and that has passed, and now she is Dolly who goes out and does everything, and is then mm-hmm. going back to Ephraim to go, okay, I'm gonna raise the roof. I'm gonna get back in the saddle.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's to some degree a trend of Yuri Herman musicals, not necessarily the getting back in the saddle, but this like main central protagonist who's coming back to fight their way back to the top.
Yes.
And that and in that sense I discern it as a trademark Yuri Herman piece of theater.
Sure. Sure.
And God damn it, Hello Dolly is up there with, you know, with I guess with Lacage, the other Yuri Herman work I've seen, as these one of the most triumphant pieces of musical theater in American history. Something mm-hmm. that makes you want to jump out of your fucking seat and go lead a march down Times Square.
Mm-hmm.
He stirs the soul. He lights a fire under your pants. He is the spirit rouser of Broadway.
You know, you touch on something that I'm not sure if it's Yuri Herman, I'm not sure if it's Michael Stewart, whoever. Might be Thornton Wilder. You can watch a clip online of Rosie O'Donnell on Watch What Happens Live. And she's there with Joy Behar. And Joy Behar, of course, was approached to do the tour of this revival. And she turned it down.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, she turned it down. I mean, she was not even entertaining it. But
did she sing?
Probably not.
Okay,
that's never stopped a Dolly before.
Well, I wouldn't say Tova can't sing. Anyway,
they started talking about the revival, and, you know, Joy Behar mentioned I liked it. And both Rosie O'Donnell and Andy Cohen were like, you didn't cry? No, I didn't cry. I was there to laugh at. And they both started talking about Put On Your Sunday Clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that the piece is so emotionally relevant, or I hate the word relevant, emotionally moving, touching. Dolly's a widow. She's not the only widow. Irene Molloy is a widow. And Horace Van de Gelder was married. His wife died at some point. He's a widower.
Unlucky bastards.
Cornelius Hackle is, what, 35? Or 33 and three quarters?
Is he?
A decent... It's a line in the show, Joshy.
I must have missed it. I thought it was, like, late 20s.
No, he's in his 30s.
Damn.
A decent amount of his life has gone by, and he's never really started.
Uh-huh.
The show is about people that for a myriad of reasons, for all kinds of experiences, people that should be depressed have a right to be depressed. And yet, they choose joy. These are not just humdrum, happy-go-lucky people. It's radical happiness.
Radical happiness.
It's radical happiness in the face of the abyss. And damn, that
well said.
Is what is so terrific. That is what makes the show. That is what moves people. Put on your Sunday clothes. When I went to see the Bette Midler revival, Bette Midler, first time I saw that production, he slammed that door shut, and Gavin Creel was on. He slammed that door shut, he looked out at the audience. Out there, there's a world outside of Yonkers! And the look of hope in his face. I immediately started bawling, and it only got worse from there. The entire number, I was a wreck. I mean, because he's so happy, and then the parade of costumes come on, and it's such an overwhelming experience of costumes. And then there's a train!
And then there's a train.
It just works. And, you know, we're talking about committee rather than singular voice. I don't care how it was created. Hello, Dolly is a perfect musical comedy. Perfect.
Yeah, I think so.
It is a perfect show, to me. At least how it was presented in this revival, and there were some slight changes. I mean, beyond Penny in My Pocket, they had a lab or two where they just sat around trying out different numbers, different pieces of the script, adding some lines from The Matchmaker back.
That's, wow, to that extent.
Yeah, it ended up not being much.
I was going to say, like with Jerry Zaks Productions, there is always very much, like, a desire to take the show, no matter what the show is, but really look at it and go, okay, regardless of what the show is, what should it be right now? What should it be for this company, for this production, for this whatever? It doesn't necessarily take anything as holy.
Mm-hmm. And they spent some time working out what is the best version of the show. And it ended up that 99% of the show as originally scripted was the best version of the show. But they did examine, and of course, beyond just the score that was there, they added Penny in My Pocket. There's two songs that Jerry Herman wrote for the movie. There's two songs that were added for Ethel Merman when Ethel Merman did it.
I'm curious, which two songs were written for the movie?
They got rid of I Put My Hand In. They got rid of the Jerry Herman fisting anthem.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And they did a song, Just Leave Everything to Me, if you want your da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It was designed to be more of a vocal showcase for Streisand.
Of course.
And then they added a song that was cut from MAME.
Oh?
Called Love Is Only Love. And MAME sang it to Patrick when Patrick first thought that he was falling in love. Jerry Herman wrote a new intro to it, and the purpose it served in the movie was basically to bridge Act 1 and Act 2, since you don't get an intermission. So, Dolly is sitting in her room and she's getting ready to go to the Harmonia Gardens, and she sings her credo about love.
Okay. Anyway, where were we before all this? Hello, Dolly, as a musical altogether. Perfect musical comedy. I'm not really inclined to disagree. It has such an action to it. It has such a
fantastic beating heart. And if nothing else, is just relentlessly funny. And that comes down to more than just, like, you know, more than just production, which, you know, sometimes with Jerry Zaks revival of shows, it's just, you wonder, okay, is this a great show or a great revival of a pretty funny show? The book is constantly active. It's constantly funny. It's constantly driving. It's constantly pushing. And it's constantly rousing. I've used that word a whole bunch, but it is constantly just an explosion of spirit.
Well, and you think of why certain musical comedies now seem dated, why certain musical comedies have stayed relevant. I think Hello, Dolly! Doesn't seem dated. I mean, to some, it probably does. To me, it doesn't, in the least. It doesn't seem dated because of the emotional material of the characters. The very existence of who they are when they walk out onto that stage. It gives the audience something to ground all of the comedy in.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's comedy is one of the greatest devices to get someone to care about something, I find. It lets your guard down, you know? It lets you more freely digest a piece. It more actively welcomes you into the world. It more actively gives you a reason to sort of position yourself in it. And that's what makes, I find, emotional content in comedy so much more heartfelt. Because you have this moment, even way before the parade passes by, where Dolly is just talking to Ephraim and letting him in on her plan. And my heart swelled in that moment. Because I was sitting there, I was going like, wow, she's letting him into her plan. He's her accomplice from beyond. And it was that kind of, like, you know, in just a, I think in a dramatic play, I probably would have gone like, oh, interesting. But, you know, with this being a comedy, with us seeing a bit more of her humor, with us seeing her heart, with us getting to sort of trust her and laugh at her, or not laugh at her, but, like, you know, let her make us laugh. When she does get emotional, when she gets vulnerable, when she gets sweet, you really, really care about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just the benefit of musical comedy altogether, the fact that it allows such a deeper emotionality. And Hello, Dolly! Capitalizes on that fantastically.
Yeah.
What, like, I guess we've kind of talked about, you know, this musical sort of embodying radical joy.
Mm-hmm.
But what is it that makes Hello, Dolly! The legacy of a show it is? Why has this persisted since the 60s? Why does this keep getting revived rather than, like, you know, why does this get more, so many more productions than MAME or something like that?
MAME, I hate to say it, MAME is dated. MAME, the book, we will cover MAME one day. The book of MAME expects that you know the story when you walk in. So it's giving you kind of a highlights version of the story that has some songs incorporated, which worked at the time. But now that no one really knows anti-MAME anymore, you're not seeing a total story told because the audience isn't filling in those details.
And I don't know, the way you talked about Hello, Dolly! And people going back to the drawing board and thinking about, like, you know, lines to include. Do you think it's, like, reparable?
What do you mean?
For MAME, could someone fill in those details? Is there still something? Not to make this a full, like, you know, not to turn this into a MAME episode.
Yeah. Hello, Dolly! As I said, they investigated every moment, but 99% of the time found out what originally was there was what worked and was what they went with.
Mm-hmm.
So while they experimented with other things, they didn't really use any of the other things. MAME would need a completely new book.
Gotcha.
MAME would need an Aaron Sorkin Camelot level rewrite.
Oh, Christ.
But good. So not at all like Aaron Sorkin's book for Camelot.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think that's exactly what you want.
That level of rewriting, but good.
Fair, fair. But what is it about Hello Dolly still that just makes it... Well, back to the original question. What is it about Hello Dolly that makes it so... That people revive it so much, that it has become one of the landmark pieces of musical comedy? Well,
besides the emotional underpinning of the show, it's a great star vehicle that can accommodate a whole plethora of stars. Really, the main qualification that you need is a big, recognizable personality. There's music she needs to be able to sing, but pretty much anyone that can carry a tune can sing the score of Hello Dolly, at least Dolly's material. You can pick correct keys for the person, and as long as they aren't tone deaf, they can sing it. You need to be able to act, but the piece, and we'll get to this later, the piece suffers from overly Uta Hagen. You look at the script and it says, you know, you need to be able to act, but the acting is not as important as here is a recognizable personality. And not only here is a recognizable personality, here is a recognizable warm personality.
Yeah.
Which is why Bette Midler was so ideal. Because you think Bette Midler, you know exactly who she is. And she knows how to bring her persona, her personality to the stage. And she knows how to be likable, how to get an audience to like her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it just keeps getting revived because it's a chance to see a star that you love succeed.
And it's just the easiest, most interchangeable, not most interchangeable, but like most open, I guess? The one that allows for the most variety of leading ladies?
I would hesitate to say most, but it allows for a wide variety.
Yeah. And you think about some of the dollies that we've had in the past, you know, like the big ones, Ethel, Pearl Bailey.
Phyllis Diller,
yes, Mary Martin. This variety of stars who wouldn't typically all be bundled in the same category.
Ginger Rogers.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. You would never categorize them together, but they've all had like decidedly successful portrayals of this character, no matter how distinct they are. Like, watching this production, I was so actively, like, sitting here going, like, fuck, I'm gonna have to watch this show, like, a dozen more times, aren't I?
Yes. And then, finally, we're talking about reasons that the show gets revived so much. It's a terrific score, regardless of who contributed, who did what. It's a tuneful, terrific score. Full of hummable show tunes.
Jerry Herman... Yeah, hummable. And I was thinking about this recently, actually. What does hummable really mean? Not in the sense of like, oh yeah, something's tuneful, something's catchy, but in the sense of like, how does one make hummable?
I don't think one can make one, either it is or isn't.
I kind of have a hint of a theory. It's a very shallow base of a theory that I'd be curious to get your thoughts on.
We're out of time today.
Oh,
so...
well, fuck. Never mind then. I'll give you the thesis another time.
Thank you for tuning in.
Yeah, have a great one, folks.
Go ahead.
If you think of Stephen Sondheim songs, or I guess the most quote-unquote unhummable ones, people think it comes down to, oh, it's too fast, it's too conversational, whatever. I think it has a lot to come down to the notes are too close together. Whereas you think of Jerry Herman, da 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 da
maybe
I didn't see that right one at all, but...
yeah, maybe pick a song that isn't in question of whether
no
or not
good, point, good point good point good point good point good point good point you think of, you know, da 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 da, you know, it's this, there's this cascading, there's this distance between the notes, there's a kind of journey there. I don't know, there's you think I put my hand in here, you think of Ribbons Down Her Back. They're kind of wide ranging, you know. There's a da 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 da. The notes jump from place to place. I don't know. I don't have the real musical vocabulary to actually talk about this specifically, but it feels there's something about the soaringness of that, of having that space and that length and having. It's a very technical thing, but I think
this is fascinating, but I think something that might put a wrench in your plans. Sondheim talked about when he did Sweeney Todd, that Sweeney Todd and Mrs. Lovett were going to use very small intervals, mostly minor thirds, if that. And then if they needed to go higher, it would slowly descend. Whereas Anthony and Joanna would, I feel you, Joanna. I mean, those are notes that are far apart.
Yeah.
So why is that not considered hummable?
I would consider that 1,000,000% hummable. Da, 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 da. If that's not one of Sondheim's most hummable songs, I don't know what is. Versus, you know, da 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 da. I don't know. I think there's something to that that just makes the human brain tick in a particular way, and I don't know what that comes down to, but I think it's something that Jerry Herman is very good at creating these very soaring things, at creating a lot of distance between those notes, and in really prioritizing those happy intervals.
I think he knows exactly where your ear is going. And he knows how to deliver that and how to slightly eschew that.
How to take where you thought you were going and... Sure.
Give it to you, but then slightly change it so that you stay mentally interested. You know, it's also fascinating. He didn't read sheet music.
Oh, one of us!
Us!
One speak of for yourself, us. Bitch. I fucking am. I speak on behalf of the sight reading challenge community.
I read music.
Well, good. Well, you know what? That's why you'll never amount to the level of Jerry Herman.
Ouch.
What can I say?
Ouch.
Sorry, that you'll hurt. Only amount to the level of Stephen Sondheim.
Yeah, backpedal any faster, bitch.
That's Hello Dolly as a show. Now, I've said this once before. I will say it again. Jerry Zaks is one of the great musical comedy revival directors in history, which is, you know, quite a subsect of a niche. But,
and tell us more about how you loved his music, man.
We won't get to that.
We won't get to that. Why?
Because it makes a hole in my point, and I will not contradict myself.
Okay.
Jerry Zaks, I'm sitting here as someone who has seen his Guys and Dolls, and who has seen his Forum, and who, yes, has seen his Music Man, but still, is now sitting here, having seen his Hello Dolly, and going, when this man is on it, he is the unabashed king of musical comedy revival. It so absolutely comes down to he knows how to get the biggest laughs at any point ever. He is one of the funniest directors in musical theater.
You know, you texted me and you asked, what is it about Jerry Zaks that makes him so great for these pieces? And my response was,
and I've been thinking a lot about this response,
there's a certain level of words that have become dirty words when you direct a musical. The words being louder, faster, funnier. And the old version of directing, they were essentially traffic cops that told people, go here, go here, go here, go here.
And that was the first time I'd ever heard the term traffic cops, too, to describe a director. Someone who just points in the direction.
George Abbott was a traffic cop. And, you know, the famous George Abbott story. Someone asked, what's my motivation? Your paycheck. And so the existence of direction was you tell people where to go and then you yell at them louder, faster, funnier. And as theater and musical theater has evolved, those three words have become dirty words. You know, if you want someone to say something faster, now you have to play the actor's playbook of, okay, well, your character really wants this, and this is the motivation, this is the want, and can we
justify, can we dramaturgically reinforce?
The issue is, not all pieces are written to have every moment necessarily justified. Great pieces can have every moment justified, but you can Stanislavski a musical to death. Some musicals can deal with that. Some you can really Stanislavski something to death. You have to take into consideration how the musical was written and what the writers were trying to accomplish. And so, if you sit down with Hello Dolly and Leroy Reams talked about, he directed Madeline Kahn in a production. And Madeline Kahn wanted justifications for everything. Well, why do I go here? Well, and he had to find a million reasons of, well, she sees Ephraim for a second, and Ephraim's over stage right, so you have to go over walk stage right to make sure that it's Ephraim. Things like that will kill a piece like Hello, Dolly. And it's great to have justification, but at the end of the day, if you have a 4-week rehearsal period and 3 weeks are spent on justification, you are going to open a show that needed a pass of louder, faster, funnier. That can't be the only tool in your tool book, but Jerry Zaks is so great because he's not afraid to use those tools.
Yeah, well said. He has such an eye for a total picture of a stage. And that's not just an aesthetic thing. That's like in terms of movement. You have a number like It Takes a Woman here. And there's this moment where the entire chorus are all just peering their heads out of various different doors and crooks and crannies. And you're just standing there like, this is fucking hysterical. And it would so take someone who has this kind of an image of this grandness, of this momentum, of this energy, of this cartoonish quality, to just imagine to put all those people there. And then you think of the choreography in, like, you know, the Motherhood March, where you have people sliding under tables and into closets and running back and forth, and you're turning Horace around and around and disguising them, and it's this like really fucking fantastically eloquent Scooby-Dooing of a set of a staging.
Cool. Do you want to talk about anything Jerry Zaks did? Because both of those moments were 100% Gower Champion.
Were they?
Yes.
Oh shit.
It's worth pointing out the revival here is heavily reminiscent of the original production. Heavily reminiscent of the original production. And when I say that, it's to such a degree that the choreography was deemed not eligible to even be nominated for a Tony Award.
Okay.
Because it was the original choreography with a step or two changed for the specific personalities on stage.
Interesting. I guess I'm not what surprised to hear that, but like
this production did was it took the original production, it asked, how do we take this? It works. And Jerry Herman certainly wants the original production on stage. I mean, there was no one that turned down more revival requests than Jerry Herman. Jerry Herman wants this original production on stage. How do we take it? How do we tweak it and make it acceptable for a 2017 audience?
Gotcha.
And that was all the terrific work that was done. It was slightly changing things. It was upping the color palette. The original production, the color palette was not as pastel-y and constant colors. But, I mean, you keep pointing out things like all of the, you know, the one ensemble guy popping up from the grain silo.
Mm-hmm.
That's Gower Champion. You texted me about the elegance scene, the backdrops kept dropping, and that's how you could tell they were changing locations. That's Gower Champion. A lot of this is Gower Champion. Just Gower Champion edited for a modern audience.
Gotcha. So how would you how would you summarize Jerry Zaks's particular contribution beyond just like editing?
He made sure it was deeply felt. He cast it well. Mm-hmm. And he was...
Did he ever?
If it was a matter of editing, he had an excellent eye of an editor, which is a large part the responsibility of the director. The director needs to be an editor.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the, I guess, biggest things about this production is how spectacular the chemistry of this cast is felt and how wonderfully the performances are directed.
Mm-hmm.
You think of the relationship between Gavin Creel and Taylor Trench here. They just so feel like, you know, a big and a little brother here. They just feel like they know each other. They have each other's instincts and quirks mapped out perfectly. There's such a caring and such a tenderness from one to the other. And then you look at, you know, so like genuinely one of the, how you're going to feel about this. One of the standout performances in this for me kind of was Beanie Feldstein because of this just like perfect calculation, towing the line between going way too big and way too much and perfectly calculating what is best utilized in what particular moment. And that comes down more than anything to an editor of a director. If you're going to stop being my friend after this episode, it would be best to just let me know now.
If I stop being your friend, I don't think it'll be because of that.
Okay, great. I thought you were going to be really upset that I complimented Beanie Feldstein on the podcast.
No, I mean, I kind of did have a stroke for a minute, and like, yeah, I couldn't find any words. But I don't think that's why we'd stop being friends.
Well, that's good to know, at least.
Well, let's talk about the production.
It's gorgeous. It's fucking God, gorgeous.
It's so beautiful to look at. I mean, the costume parade and put on your Sunday clothes.
Oh, and yeah. It got applause.
Yes, of course it got applause. And you know what else got applause? Endless applause that didn't get a lot of applause here.
Mm.
The title number.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you go for that title number, and I mean, the first time I saw it, Full House standing ovation after that number. Immediately. Mm-hmm. Immediately. It wasn't even, are we going to stand up? No. Bam! Boom! Mm-hmm. Everyone's out of their seats, screaming their heads off. And, I mean, when the revival opened, someone, I believe, referred to the title number of Hello Dolly as musical theater porn. And it really is. It really is. I mean, every dance step started getting applause. They did the duck walk. Everyone started applauding. She went around the passerelle. Everyone started applauding. I mean, literally just about every single step. Every single noticeable dance step got its own round of applause.
Mm.
And it just adds, and it adds, and it adds, and it blows the roof off the house. But the set, I mean, my God, that set was so gorgeous.
And you know what's so interesting about it? I was sitting there watching, and I was going, this feels like a huge production. But at the same time, there's never more than, like, one really distinct set piece at a time, you know? The thing leading up to Put On Your Sunday Clothes, it's a bare stage with a drop and then a train comes on.
Well, you have to make room for the train.
Well, yeah. But then you also look at, you know, the like, what is it? The ballet just after Dancin'. I'm calling it Dancin'. The ballet just after Dancin', that again is just an empty stage and a drop. And so much of this show is just an empty stage and a drop. And you look at it and you go, but this feels so grand. And it feels so big and it feels so lavish.
It's how you populate the space with people.
And that's it. And that's exactly it. It's about how do you use the real estate you have? How do you make it feel like it's consistently full and active and brimming and explosive? And how do you make, and it comes down to the color palette as well, to the lighting design, to the saturation in the set and costume design. It comes into how do you make this feel like it's bursting? And it's not just about getting all the most expensive and all the most detailed and all the most magnificent, meticulous set pieces. It's about curation more than anything.
Money is not a substitute for inspiration.
Yup.
Which actually, they probably should have remembered the next time they had a musical revival.
Yeah, kind of.
It's about how you populate the stage with people. It's about giving people visual elements to look at that are interesting and that keep adding. It's just terrific.
Just because it's not a meticulously detailed production 24/7, just because it's not always, just because we don't always have Horace's shop, just because we don't always have Harmonia Gardens, just because we don't always have et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it still feels consistently huge. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that it's not a big production. You look at fucking the set of Horace's place. It's fantastic.
Not only that, that train is huge.
Yes, it is. I'm sitting there going, how the fuck does this show tour if you have to put a, if you have to cart a train from city to city?
I think the train was slightly smaller on tour. Oh. Not only that, you go to the Harmonia Gardens, and something that did not tour. You go to the Harmonia Gardens, I don't know if you noticed, the side panels, she makes the entrance, and the side panels next to her were what looked like, in person, very heavy, intricate glass art pieces.
Whoa. Oh, yeah.
Like, when you look, take an old person candy bowl and turn it to the bottom.
Yeah,
if you made like that glass, into, yeah. It was not stained glass, it was clear glass, but it was intricately designed. And if you turn that into a huge wall, those were on the stage. And the two glass pieces did not tour. Mm. They just had a drop behind that. Another example, it was a huge production.
And that comes down to, in large part, its producer.
Yeah.
We have to have the conversation, unfortunately.
What conversation?
This was produced by
a man with a song in his heart.
The Scourge of Broadway.
A song in his heart, a smile on his face.
And a sandwich
and a knife
projected
in his hand
onto the wall in front of him. I'm proud of that one.
Okay.
Yeah, this was produced by, what's his name? I can't even remember his name anymore.
I don't know if you know who Scott Rudin is. Yeah.
Well, Scott Rudin produced this. And wasn't there a whole thing afterward about the fact that this like just barely recouped at the end?
Yes. Allegedly, the investors saw something like a 5% return.
Which, like, what the fuck? I'm here. You know
what that
I'm
was?
I'm gonna do some Googling. You talk about this.
Yeah, what that was is Scott Rudin to increase his influence and power, advertise the show more than he needed to. Frankly, he kept buying full page ads in the New York Times when Bette Midler was in it, and her entire run was sold out. Like, there was not a ticket to be had, and he's spending $100K a week on advertising that he doesn't need to be spending. And also, the show was in tech. The show was about to head into an invited dress. There was a blizzard in the city, and Scott Rudin called a company meeting into the middle of the house, and he said, every single one of you has a room up the street at the Westin. I don't know which hotel. It was an expensive hotel. He paid to put everybody associated with the production up a couple blocks away from the theater so they would show up on time.
Wow.
He spent money like it was going out of style on this because he thought there's no way it will never not recoup. And then it almost didn't.
Wow.
And the investors were very angry because they were expecting a run like the original production of Hello, Dolly.
To go for years and years and years and years and years.
Go for years and years. And everyone heard some of the names that they called in to see if they were interested in replacing. And they were. There were so many opportunities to have replacement dollies. So they were expecting a 5-year run.
And this lasted a year and a half.
Yeah. Bernadette Peters came in. And it did well. But it wasn't the sellout hit in town.
Yeah.
And Scott
Rudin came in, like, what, the beginning of 2018?
Yeah.
The grosses went from $2.5 million a week to $1 million a week.
Yeah. Respectable grosses. And she got them to recoup. Like, she sold very well. It was not the sellout hit, and Scott Rudin had his attentions elsewhere. And also, Jerry Herman was still with us and didn't necessarily want to approve many replacements. He had his ideas of who should do the role, and those ideas were not necessarily synonymous with who they would get and who would sell tickets.
All that being said, it's a great production. Fantastically designed, fantastically choreographed, fantastically cast, fantastically chemistried, just musical theater bliss. They say, one of the things they say about directing, the most important job of a director, and the thing that will end up doing most of the work once it's done, is the casting. You get a perfect cast for a show, the director's work is for the most part done. And this company here is so truly, so aggressively representative of that.
You decide where we start.
Okay, Beanie Feldstein.
Oh, of course you did.
You give me the fucking ball, I'll chuck it.
Go ahead.
Beanie was great. Beanie was absolutely great in this. I thought she was hysterical.
I cannot be objective about Beanie Feldstein.
Why? Misogyny? Anti-Semitism?
What? How dare?
Homophobia?
How very dare?
On Pride Month, really? Wow.
How very dare? I can't be... The thing is, I think her performance is overdone here. I don't know if it's actually overdone, or I'm seeing the seedlings of what she's going to do in Funny Girl, and it's just going to come off completely amateurish in Funny Girl. So then I can't actually look at what she did here. You know?
I know from your perspective and your perspective alone. I will not say I know to mean I understand.
You understand how someone could get to that point where they're saying, I don't know if I'm watching you or if I'm watching a reaction to something else you did.
Yes, I do understand how someone could come to that conclusion, and I particularly understand how Daniel Durant could come to that conclusion. I call him Daniel Durant because I didn't have a last name for him in my contacts, and it just felt appropriate.
Now, folks, we bring you direct from Phoenix live and in person.
Danny Durant.
Here she is at last. Twinkle in her eye. Hot off the press. Nevertheless.
No, there's the flashback. There's the flashback here. Sally, Sally, will you zip up my dress? That's Beanie Feldstein. Let's move on now to Taylor Trench.
Taylor Trench, who is 17 here. He was...
Really?
Yeah, playing 17. Wait.
Oh, he's okay.
Playing 17. This season, he's in Camelot, where he's playing 14. The show before Camelot, I think...
It was Dear Evan Hansen.
And he was playing 16.
Fuck, he's getting younger. He's Benjamin Buttoning.
Yeah, before that, I think it was Curious Incident, and he was 15 there. And the show before that, I think, was Matilda, where he was about 8.
How old is this motherfucker?
One of these days, he'll finish going through puberty. I forgot To Kill a Mockingbird, which was also in there, and he was also about 8 in that.
You have anything to say about him?
Taylor Trench was very enjoyable, very likable. He's really a perfect Barnaby. Unfortunately, he was replaced by Little Charlie Stemp from England.
Isn't he going to be in Crazy for You?
He's now leading Crazy for You. He did Mary Poppins, and at the time he did Half a Sixpence, and was the lead of Half a Sixpence in London, the big Half a Sixpence revival. And
how much of a sixpence was it worth?
I don't know, I didn't see it.
Oh, okay.
They were leading up to Little Charlie Stemp is going to be the big musical theater find across both sides of the pond. And no one could really understand why they brought him over. But when he came in to do the role, he's a big dancer. So they added a bunch of dance specialties for him during dancing and the dancing ballet. So he also took part in the Waiters Gallop. They re-choreographed that so he would have a decent amount of dancing in that. So you think of the revival... Unfortunately, you don't think of Taylor Trench, you think of Little Charlie Stemp, because he had more to do. But Taylor Trench is perfect, really.
Yeah, it's a fantastically tuned performance. It's absolutely hilarious. He's zesty, he's hilarious, he's very good at playing that obliviousness, and that... There's this like great comedic trope of the guy who's just sort of pulled by the wrist, and is just the fucking rag doll. Who's dragged along from place to place. And he fits that model perfectly.
I think this is the first time you've ever referred to a performer as zesty. Happy
and
Pride.
Who the fuck would have thought it would have been about Taylor fucking Trench?
Yeah.
Kate Baldwin.
Kate Baldwin uses a brazen amount of mixing.
Yeah.
In Hello, Dolly.
Yeah.
I mean, she really is mixing the entirety of Ribbons Down My Back.
Yeah.
And I know some people went to see it and didn't like it because of that. I think it's rather thrilling, personally.
You know, this was my first time ever seeing Kate Baldwin perform.
What?
Yeah.
So many sins. So many sins.
My first time seeing a Kate Baldwin performance, she's very good. I liked her very much. She's a very fine actress. She has a very radiant... sort of
radiant. That's the great word. That she's radiant.
Yeah,
she's lovely to watch. She sings beautifully. It's a brazen use of mixing. She is enjoyable.
Brazen, you and your backhanded compliments, my God.
Well, it is a brazen use of mixing. No one else had mixed that song like that before.
I can't confirm or deny. I thought it was gorgeously sung.
It was. It was also a brazen use of mixing.
Really, really, really happy about that. Mm-hmm. You're really happy about that brazen use of mixing.
Well, it was!
Yeah, I support it. Let's move right along to the Crisis Blonde himself, Gavin Creel.
Excuse me, I think you need to lead with something else there.
Now we turn to one of the people culpable in... Sutton Foster, Crisis Blonde, Gavin Creel.
That's not what you lead with here.
Oh, sorry, what do I lead with?
I don't know, you might want to mention that this is Tony winner Gavin Creel and his Tony winning performance.
I could do that.
Why don't you?
What's up?
Why don't you?
Why don't I what?
Do that.
Do what?
What did you think of Tony winner Gavin Creel and his Tony-winning performance?
Perfect. It was absolutely charming. It was hilarious. It was spectacularly sung. It's the kind of shit you look at and go, they don't make them like this anymore. Except they do, because it happened in 2017.
I really was shocked at how much I loved him in this. I had never, I don't think I had seen him live, but of course everyone grew up with cast recordings of him. Mm-hmm. You watch him in Hello, Dolly, and he has the old school showbiz panache that is rare to find anymore, honestly, but is needed. Is needed.
Panache. Panache, that's it, yeah.
He has the panache, he has the charm, he radiates the right mood for the show, and he sings like a dream.
It's a brilliant, brilliant performance, and it has so much beauty to it. So much beauty. So much delight, and I've used this word before, but again, it's radiance. It's something that he has a gleam that reaches the back of the fucking house.
It's a very deserving Tony-winning performance. Yep.
I concur. All right, now we get down to our big two. We get down to the ticket sellers. Let's start with David Hyde Pierce.
David Hyde Pierce is cast against type here.
Yeah, kind of.
He is not what one would expect from a Horace Van de Gelder.
And you know what? I could tell that watching the show. I could tell very much that this was David Hyde Pierce's take on Horace, and that this is definitely not what this role typically would call for. It felt like the role would be so much more of a straight man performance, you know?
Louis J. Stadlin did the tour. And okay. That is exactly who you think Horace Van de Gelder is. That is the most typical casting possible for the role. But famous story, in the playbill he was above the title. And when it comes Tony time, people above the title are considered leading. People below the title are put in featured.
Yeah.
Now Horace Van de Gelder is clearly not a leading character in Dolly. He's featured. Scott Rudin started proceedings to petition him down. If your billing doesn't match the category, you have to petition the Tony Awards to have them change your category. Scott Rudin initiated petitioning him down to featured. And David Hyde Pierce got wind of it, and he said, I think Gavin has a decent shot at winning. I already have a Tony Award.
Oh.
I don't want to take any votes away from him. This would mean a lot to him.
Oh, man.
Don't petition me down.
Oh, wow. He martyred himself for the good of Gavin.
You know, he's not what you expect, but in his own way, he is perfect. And why he is perfect is because he finds his way in, he's able to do comedy, and he's able to do comedy for comedy's sake, but he's enough of an actor that he's able to create a character that matches the comedic bits that are expected.
Yes, absolutely. And it's so perfectly attuned to what he's great at, but he makes it all seem logical within that parameter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the thing that I think of the most when I think of like the David Hyde Pierce-isms of the role is when they're in the Harmonia Gardens and Jen Simard is just there shaken and David Hyde Pierce is just going no 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 no, and it goes on for like 45 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at that and I'm like, that can't be what, like, Horace Van de Gelder does. That's just David Hyde Pierce, and it's working fucking perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very welcome... And, you know, like, one of the best things that, like, reinforces that, I find, is Penny in My Pocket. Like, it's a moment that probably under a different performer wouldn't have served as great of a beat, you know? But for David Hyde Pierce, is exactly the kind of thing that complements his very distinct take on this character.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about making the character work to who you are, while still, like, you know, not sacrificing the character for that sake. It's something that we, very weird relationship, but it's something that I also thought was one of the great parts of Ben Platt's performance in Parade. You know? You look at that and you go, that's not necessarily...
Sorry, I just had another stroke.
We've both said this. You've agreed with me to this point. Ben Platt's performance in Parade is not really at all what Leo Frank inherently is by nature of writing this. Or I guess to what I'm more trying to say is that when Ben Platt is in Parade, Ben Platt, to a very certain extent, is playing Ben Platt. But the thing is, he's also in consideration of the character he's playing, and within that, he takes steps to make the character work within his outline rather than impose his own outline on the script of this show. He actually takes the character and makes it fit to him, and he wears him like a suit. And that's something that a good, distinctive actor does. If they're not a chameleon, they'll make the character work for them, and that's the mark of greatness in David Hyde Pierce's performance.
Okay.
I got out of it, baby. I got out of it unscathed.
Okay.
Anyhow, all this to say, David Hyde Pierce, great.
Great. You know, he did something when I saw him with Bette Midler.
Just one thing?
That I did not see them do anywhere else, and I have looked at some of the other tapes and recordings, and I have not seen them do it at any other performance. And honestly, it kind of upsets me, because it was kind of the best acted moment of the entire show from both of them. So it's the final confrontation, and I'm never marrying again, Dolly, because I found the perfect wife, and it's you, damn it. And there's a big laugh. It's a big laugh line. And they're doing a jovial comedy scene. Well, at the performance I went to, I'm not marrying again because I found the perfect wife, and it's you. Damn it. And it was like, he didn't get a laugh there. He clearly did not mean to get a laugh there. And Bette Midler then played off of that, because she has the line of, if you married again, your wife would have to be a benefactress to half of the town, would have to do this, would have to do that. And so all of a sudden, they found this shading where he's kind of angry at himself that he won't allow himself to marry Dolly Levi, and he's kind of said it out loud, and she's heard it. She has to react to it in some way, but Ephraim hasn't given her the go-ahead yet to say that she can get married to him, so all of a sudden she'd have to be a benefactress to half of the town, half of this. She's like pushing him away, because you can't do this now. I haven't had the sign from Ephraim. Yeah. And it was such a fascinating shade from both of them that I don't know where it came from, and it certainly isn't in any of the bootlegs of those two, but the night I was there, it was the most fascinating, well-acted moment in the show. And I wonder if they just were concerned about sacrificing a laugh line, but it made it a stronger experience.
That sounds fucking incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anyone else to talk about?
Dolly.
Oh, yeah. You have anything to say about her?
We have Donna... two-time Tony winner.
Donna Murphy. What have we talked about
Tuesday
her
Dolly.
What have we said about her? We've talked about her in Anyone Can Whistle.
We did, yeah.
Anything else?
That's it?
I
think that's it.
Damn. Donna Murphy is one of the greatest performers we have right now.
Yes.
I can't imagine that as anything but incontrovertible fact.
My first time seeing her in person was Dear World.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
And Dear World really cemented to me. Specifically, the place that she took I Don't Want to Know in Dear World just kind of cemented to me, oh, she's one of the great musical theater leading ladies of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And in a word, she's terrific here.
Yeah. And in many more words, Donna Murphy is not only one of the great performers in musical theater, she's one of the great singers, she's one of the great comedians, she's sure as shit one of the great vocalists, and she's just one of the sincerest, most heartfelt presences that we have. She is so spectacularly, fantastically attuned to what is the absolute best, most perfectly calculated performance to give this audience right now. She's just one of those indefatigable stalwarts who anytime you see her, you know that she is going to be at 100% and she's going to be giving you the most robust performance you could possibly be getting in that moment. You will never, you're never in question of the vocal strength. You're never in question of how funny she is. You're never in question that she's going to deliver the emotionality.
Robust is a great word. Her performance here is robust, and she performs to the absolute height of her abilities in Dolly.
Mm-hmm. In everything.
I find it interesting, though. She was better in Dear World than Dolly. Dolly is about a definable personality and a warm personality. And Donna Murphy certainly has personality. And she can be warm. But where Donna Murphy really excels is finding the dark psychological underpinnings of a character. And that's not necessarily Hello, Dolly. She does great work here, but she's more suited to something like Dear World, where she's playing the mad woman of Shio, and it's a weird script, and she has to string together all these different strands, and is the character crazy? Do we just call her crazy? She's creating a completely different character than herself. That's the type of work where she flies to the absolute heights, peak musical theater. Hello, Dolly. She's terrific. It's not 100% her show. It's a show she can do very well, but it is not intrinsically her show. Dear World, that is her show.
And I think, you know, to some extent, it has to do with the fact that you texted me really early on while you were watching something along the lines of like, oh, God, she's not being funny.
Something along the line. It got pretty early on and she wasn't landing all of the laughs. And we should mention, I think this is about her third performance in the run. And she certainly cemented a lot more of the comedy later on in the run. I did go back and watch other parts of other videos. She cemented a lot of that work. Still, though, while she is terrific, there's always going to be that dark edge to her. Mm. And that's part of what makes her so great. But that dark edge isn't put to its best use in this show. So while she can be great in this show, it's not 100% copacetic with her.
I guess I see what you're saying. I guess, yeah.
Do you think that was pointless?
No, not entirely.
I think it goes back to what I was saying at the beginning. It's about the warmth of the person playing Dolly, and it's about having an identifiable personality. Donna Murphy has an identifiable personality, but it's not totally in line with Dolly Levi.
Okay. I can get behind what you're saying. But again, if nothing else, you're getting a magnificent performance from Donna Murphy in whatever it is she's doing. You know you're seeing a performer at the top of their skill.
Yes.
If
I do not debate that, yeah.
And the last thing to talk about here, which I'm going to give you your space for because you have a big bone to pick here, the video.
F minus.
We never this hyperbolize on the is podcast.
F minus. You have the end of Hello Dolly, the Dolly number. She comes around the passerelle. She's center stage, living in her glory. Dolly'll never go away again. And there's a head in front of her. And we don't see Dolly in her absolute moment of triumph. F minus.
Misses the passerelle a bit. Otherwise, a great video. That's my take on it. I never really felt like I was missing much of the action. There were a couple tiny obstructed moments. But overall...
It's also odd. I think this is the first time where we're watching a video of a production I saw in person multiple times, so I know exactly what's being missed.
Right, fair. I, the viewer, didn't feel like I was left out of the conversation with this production, and that's just about what I look for when I watch a bootleg. There are moments of dropout, and there are moments of stuff being missed, but it's nothing that obstructed my understanding of the production. I give it an A-.
It's a B.
Okay.
Sorry, F-. It needed Dolly and her moment of triumph at the end of the title song.
And Hello Dolly the Musical? Yeah, that could be a grade.
Dare you grade Hello Dolly as a musical?
Yeah, because we can't say that for every show we do.
Well, I mean, there are certain... You know, we really have been skimping, because I'm thinking the terrible shows were like, it doesn't exist on a normal grading scale.
Yeah, and then of the great shows, we go, awful. Oh, it transcends grading. It transcends... We gotta give something a letter when it's got a fucking letter.
Fine, Hello Dolly's A+.
Got a letter, it's A. I give
A+.
It an A.
A plus.
It's the kind of thing that feels endlessly remountable, endlessly rewatchable. It has a bottomless possibility of casts, and it has what feels like an absolute timeless quality to it. It feels like it's one of the musicals that could very well last till the end of time.
And may it live forever.
May it.
All right, well, next episode, Joshy, is your pick. It's our other June Pride Month episode. Why don't you tell the listener what we're going to cover?
Is it my pick?
It is.
All right, well, it's Pride Month. It's gotta be gay. The prom. We're watching The Prom.
No.
Oh, okay.
No. Gay executive vetoing that. I will not have that be our Pride Month episode.
All right, cool. Yeah, let's go something. Something a bit more higher quality. Priscilla. We're watching Priscilla.
Really?
I don't know. I'm just thinking of something that might. I want to do falsettos.
You can't do that.
Jesus, I've gone too goddamn long without watching falsettos, and by God, I'm putting a fucking.
Can you actually properly introduce it then?
Falsettos! I gave it the extravagance it needed. None of this is being cut. Folks, next week, we're going to talk about one of the great touchstone pieces of modern musical theater. One of the most contemporarily popular pieces. One of the great pieces of gay art in musical theater. William Finn's falsettos. I haven't seen this shit.
Oh, that'll be nice.
I've had years and years and years and years of every single fucking person of my life going, what do you mean you haven't seen falsettos? It's not a lack of wanting. I've just never gotten to it. And you know what?
You've never seen it.
We're going to fucking get to it. Shut up. It's not a lack of wanting.
You've never seen it.
Shut up. And it's not a lack of wanting. And it's now I'm finally forcing myself to have the fucking time to do it. Happy Pride Month.
Which one?
I think it's got to be the pro shot. I think it's got to be.
Okay, I guess
As I want to watch the original Broadway production with Mandy Patinkin, I think that's got to be my own recreational thing. I think we got to talk about the pro shot. I think that's the one that the most people are going to be on board with.
But I'm not going to be on board with them.
Not on board with, but on the same page as us.
I don't know. I kind of just want to watch Mandy.
I do too.
When I eviscerate Christian and Andrew Rannells. And
I'm sorry, have I ever stopped left. You? Have I ever stopped you from eviscerating either one of those people on this podcast, ever?
When we have no listeners left, it's going to be your fault, and we should have just gone with Mandy Patinkin.
Folks, it's falsettos. You want to listen to this one? I want to listen to this one. Come join us. Or else you're homophobic. Happy Pride Month. And you're anti-Semitic!
If you enjoyed the episode, rate us, review us, and subscribe to us on your platform of choice.
And if you have any recommendations, questions, or virtual flowers to send our way, email us at unccpodcast@gmail.com.
The Unauthorized Critic Circle podcast is unauthorized. The podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only.
Dolly
and all names, pictures, and audio clips are registered trademarks and or copyright of the respective trademark and copyright holders. The Unauthorized Critic Circle cannot help the listener locate or distribute the recordings discussed herein.